The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. There are a few things that we can safely predict about tonight's State of the Union speech. It will be punctuated by a lot of applause from President Obama's supporters. It will be followed by criticism from Republicans. And you'll hear someone from PolitiFact doing point-by-point fact-checking on tomorrow's morning edition. Only this year, PolitiFact will be fact-checking President Obama's address and the Republican response in real time. And that's thanks to a successful Kickstarter campaign that raised $15,000 for the project. Angie Drobnik-Holen is editor for PolitiFact, and she's here to talk with us about how to prepare a truth squad for something that has yet to happen. Angie, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
Angie, listeners may have heard of PolitiFact's Truth-O-Meter and its infamous Pants on Fire rating, but remind us of what it is and what it does.
We are an independent group of journalists who fact-check American politics. We fact-check elected leaders, we fact-check candidates, we look at advocacy groups. Our sister site, Pundit Fact, fact-checks the talking heads that you see on cable news or hear on talk radio. And our mission is to bring people accurate, independent information to help them make decisions about exercising their democratic right to vote.
And when you say independent, it's nonpartisan. This is a, let's say, equal opportunity fact-checking, correct?
That's right. We fact-check Republicans, Democrats, everybody in between.
You launched the Kickstarter campaign to cover the costs of fact-checking the president's speech, $15,000. And full disclosure, I did contribute a couple weeks ago. What is that money going to do?
We're using the money for two things. Number one, we're adding to our usual staff. Our national politics fact-checking staff for this type of event is usually three people. We're going to have about 10 people on it tonight. The other thing that we're doing is that we're using some new technology tools to try to provide more of a real-time fact-checking experience. We are partnering with Genius to annotate the speeches, and we're using Scribble Live to put out our fact checks as the speech unfolds.
As it unfolds. So what does that mean for listeners and viewers? What can they expect? They're listening to something, they hear something, you know, everyone's applauding. And they go to PolitiFact and see what?
If they're on our homepage, they'll see fact checks that we've done on the same talking point, and they'll have a very clear idea of whether that talking point is completely accurate or maybe not so accurate. Now, I should say this speech is prepared in advance. Mm-hmm. The White House staff puts a lot of effort into vetting this speech. We don't usually find egregious errors of fact. We find some spin. We find a lot of missing context. We find another way to look at the numbers. So I think if readers come to our website, we're going to give them the rest of the story.
So how far in advance do you get the text of the speech?
About 30 minutes to 2 minutes before the speech starts.
Wow. How do you prepare for such a thing, Andy? I mean, I'm sure there are some main ideas we can predict, as you mentioned, but do you have checkers assigned to, particular lie beats?
You know, we follow the president's public appearances pretty closely all year round. Now, as we've gotten closer to the State of the Union, President Obama has been giving speeches that the White House has even billed as leading up to the State of the Union. So the way we handle all political speeches is we read them, we look for the factual claims, we stay away from opinions, although interestingly, sometimes the line is a little fuzzy between what's a fact and what's an opinion.
Yeah, could you give us an example?
Here's an example of something that is hard to fact check. Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, released a book last week, and he said it's no surprise that our tax code actively discriminates against families raising children. And we had a long discussion about whether we should fact check that. Does the tax code discriminate against families raising children? Well, the word discriminate at its literal core means treats them differently. And there's not really any doubt that the tax code does treat people who have dependents differently than those who don't. And we just decided to take a pass because it seemed he was more saying that he doesn't like the way the tax code treats families raising children. So that's an example where it sounded like a fact, but when we really sat down and thought about it, it was more of an opinion.
So that's Marco Rubio from his new book, American Dreams. You know, you are bipartisan, but among the charges that has been made from critics is what you choose to check. You just gave us an example of something you discuss. How do you choose what you're checking?
We follow our news judgment in what to check. We try to follow the issues that are in the news that day, and we think about what would people be curious about. We're also attracted to things that sound wrong to us. So if we hear something that sounds wrong, we're very likely to fact check it. If we hear something that just arouses our curiosity, we're also likely to fact check it. We try to fact check approximately the same number of Republicans and Democrats, but we also try to fact check other types of people of political persuasions who aren't so easily categorized. One thing that we don't try to do is balance our ratings. Like if we have a false for a Democrat, we don't go find a false for a Republican and vice versa. We let the ratings come out however they come out.
This is so interesting because people are used to being able to hear the State of the Union, to digest it a little bit, to hear the responses. It sinks in a different way. This could really affect how people respond to the State of the Union.
You know, it's interesting because the State of the Union has been evolving over the years. I think for those who can remember back to when there were only three networks, I think these speeches were really times when a lot of the country came together at the same time to hear the same message. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think even the White House expects that. You know, the State of the Union will happen in the evening, but some people will just see the news reports the next day. Some people will follow it on Twitter. Some people may see video that's out there on the web. People are getting their news from a lot of different sources. And interestingly, we find a lot of activity on Twitter on State of the Union night for those people who use that service. People like to talk with each other in real time about what is being said during the speech.
Will you actually be fact-checking any of that? You know, if there's a back and forth on Twitter?
It depends. If it's someone prominent enough, we certainly will. We try to fact-check things that people have heard of, statements that have an impact. So if your Uncle Bob says something on Twitter that's wrong, we might not check it. On the other hand, if it's somebody with a large Twitter following who has a lot of influence on the public debate, then yes, we would check that.
Boy, you don't even want to start with my Uncle Bob. Angie Drobnik-Holen, editor of PolitiFact and member of the PolitiFact team that won the Pulitzer Prize for its coverage of the 2008 election. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
And good luck tonight.
Thanks.
Stick around for more Word of Mouth. Up next, we're going to tackle a fast-growing issue in the 21st century, digital hoarding. That's after a quick break when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
We eat in here. We get a lot of fast food. Sometimes we'll get things that we can microwave. And when we're done, the paper plates, the cups, the pizza boxes go on the floor. It's not good, but that's the truth.
That was a clip from season 5 of Hoarders, the reality show from A&E that looks inside the homes of people who are surrounded by clutter, yet unable to let any of it go. It's a show that provokes in viewers a range of disgust and claustrophobia and sympathy, and the question, how could anybody live like that? In an age when so much information is kept in the cloud or on hard drives, hoarding is no longer a strictly physical problem, and one that anyone can be guilty of without even realizing it. Lizzie Crocker is a reporter for The Daily Beast, where we found her article, I'm a Digital Hoarder. Lizzie, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you admit in your piece that hoarding runs in the family. How did it manifest?
It does indeed. In the family, my parents are in their 70s, and they are, unfortunately, they sort of think that they're building a mausoleum for themselves in my childhood home.
What do they keep?
My mother keeps everything from mail to catalogs, and she's never been able to throw away things that she kept from her her parents' house after they passed away, and my father's parents' house after they passed away. So just things that keep accumulating and piling up in rooms that are not even we don't even use anymore. Mm. And it is very, you know, it's crippling for her. And then the anxiety is so bad that she knows she has a problem, but she can't do anything to sort of stop.
So what does digital hoarding look like, since it's not something that's immediately apparent once you walk into the door?
Well, that's the thing. You know, it's not the stereotype that we think of. You know, it's not the crazy cat lady who lives amid the garbage or in newspapers and lots of clutter. But it is, the sort of clinical term for it is infomania. And it's defined as obsessively cataloging information to the extent that you neglect your day-to-day responsibilities. So it's a bit more subtle than regular hoarding, obviously.
So what do you catalog? What do you keep?
What do I keep? Mm-hmm. I keep everything from, well, as a journalist, I'm constantly looking at stories that inspire me. And I catalog them often in my Google documents. So I'll have, you know, hundreds of Google documents, many of them titled, you know, inspiration or fuel for polemic. And then I'll also have, I have 46 subfolders in my webmail. I can't believe I'm admitting to all of this right now. But 46 subfolders in my webmail that are, some of them are sort of humorous emails between colleagues, others are a list of email chains from Hurricane Sandy when we were all, you know, forced to leave our office on the West Side Highway near the river in New York. And then, you know, much less useful stuff such as a folder of every single, I've worked here for 4 years now, of every single colleague that's left, and they all write a goodbye email. And then I have that goodbye email in my goodbye Daily Beast folder. And
Let me just stop you and ask, do you ever go back to these things a second time?
I very rarely I do. But there's an element of procrastination in here for me. Mm-hmm. And I've seen this with some of my other peers or people who are, you know, keep things digitally. When you ask them to find something, can you bring up that video that you were talking about or that article that you were talking about? And then they're unable to find it.
Oh.
So there's sort of this illusion that you're really organized.
If you consider that psychologists have, they say that the compulsion to hoard may stem from either some kind of fear, you know, there won't be enough, or nostalgia. Do you think your digital collecting shares any of those roots?
I managed to be functional, so, you know, I keep a job. But I think there are people for whom this is such a, you know, this is so disabling that they're really not functional, right? But there's several things that it's about. One of them is about, you know, it's the idea that there's that story that was written last week that you have to read. And we have terms for this. We have the, in case you missed it, what if I missed reading some excellent article, or I have to go back to read this? And from what I've been told, I mean, I'm in my late 20s, but from what I've been told, that before you missed the news and you let it go and you were on to the next thing.
Well, that's the thing, you know, that we live in the information age, right? We have to gobble everything up. But isn't that what we were presented with the advantage of in the information age, that online space is unlimited? We can keep everything, you know. We have tools to search through it if we want to, and it doesn't have to clutter our homes. So the cost isn't apparent. Well, what is the cost of digital hoarding as far as you're concerned?
The cost of digital hoarding is the compulsion and the fear of losing this stuff, mm-hmm. if it overtakes you, if it becomes an obsession, if it becomes something that you're spending more time on Pinterest, or if you're spending more time, you know, making sure you're clipping an article into Pocket or into your saving it to a Google Doc, to some folder in the ether, than you are engaging with people in over the dinner table or whatnot, then that's the cost, and that's the sort of debilitating aspect of it.
I'm honestly not making light of this by saying that you've admitted this publicly, right? I'm borrowing from that, you know, 12-step terminology. You know, you've written an article about your digital hoarding. So is this a turning point for you? Is this a signal of a change?
I think it's certainly something for me to be more aware of, especially in terms of spending more money to house my various bits and bytes collections. I think that, you know, now I've been going through and trying to delete things more and more, and I've been better about deleting things in my email folders. So it is something that I'm certainly more aware of.
Well, Lizzie Crocker, thanks for coming clean with us.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Lizzie Crocker, reporter for The Daily Beast, and you can find a link to read her article, I'm a Digital Hoarder. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. And we'd like to know what you think. Can't throw out old emails? Are you avoiding sorting through your thousands of digital photos? Does that hoard of junk that you keep on the cloud weigh on you, make you anxious as if it were piled up on your living room floor? Let us know. You can share your hoarding habits on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouth. Radio. Before the mass market digital camera, photography was an expensive pastime. And even if you could afford to shoot as much as you wanted, there was only so much space on a roll of film or on the shelf for your photo albums. Digital photography introduced the potential for hoarding, when taking thousands of pictures, editing out those worth keeping became that much more difficult. In the realm of science, though, it's obvious that some photos are definitely worth saving. Producer Veronique LaCapra explains.
According to his WashU website, biomedical engineer Li-Hung Wong and his research lab have invented or discovered a whole bunch of high-tech imaging techniques, like functional photoacoustic tomography, dark field confocal photoacoustic microscopy, time-reversed ultrasonically encoded optical focusing, and a whole bunch of other things I've never heard of. So it probably won't come as a surprise that the new camera Wong's team has developed isn't exactly your ordinary point-and-shoot.
For the first time, humans can literally see light pulses traveling in space at a speed of light.
The speed of light is just over 186,282 miles per second. Going that fast, it would take you about a second to go all the way around the world 7.5 times.
Based on Einstein's theory of relativity, any mass or energy can propagate only up to the speed of light. So we're literally talking about the fastest phenomenon in the world.
So how do you take a picture of a light pulse moving at, well, the speed of light? Wong says you start with something called a streak camera. That's S-T-R-E-A-K, streak.
The streak camera is a very specialized device that allows us to convert time into space.
Say that again. It can convert what?
So you have to convert time into space.
That's what I thought he said. How do you do that?
We convert light particles or photons into electrons, then pull the electrons really hard at different rates depending on the time of arrival. So the time of arrival will be converted into different vertical positions.
Turning time into space. Simple, right? It only gets more complicated from here, so let me skip to the punchline. Wong's new technology improves on previous ultrafast cameras in two important ways. Up until now, streak cameras could only take a one-dimensional snapshot. Think of it like trying to take a picture of something flying by really fast behind a vertical slit. And the fastest cameras had to have an external light source to work. Wong's technique doesn't need special lighting, and it produces two-dimensional images, more like a regular photograph, but at a rate of one every 10 trillionths of a second.
It's a big deal.
That's Dartmouth biomedical engineer Brian Pogue.
Anytime that you create a system that images 1,000 times faster than what exists today, that's a big deal.
Pogue wasn't involved with developing the new imaging system, but he reviewed it for the journal Nature, where Wang's research is published. Pogue says this new way of visualizing the movement of light could lead to major scientific breakthroughs in fields like physics and military defense.
Things like optical cloaking or...
Cloaking? Like Star Trek cloaking? That kind of cloaking?
Yes.
In science fiction, cloaking is a technology that can make an object, like a spaceship, disappear. Pogue says it's something the military would like to be able to do in real life.
There's a lot of interest in, you know, getting light to bend around objects so it sort of looks like you're seeing through them.
Pogue says Wang's new system would allow researchers to image the light as it bends, something they haven't been able to do before, and that could help make optical cloaking a reality. Li Hung Wang imagines other uses for the new camera, from molecular biology to astronomy. Really, any field where ultrafast imaging could lead to new discoveries. I'm Veronique Capra.
Another big breakthrough for scientific imaging happened just this week when NASA created what is being called the largest picture ever captured. It's a photo composed of more than 400 separate images taken by the Hubble telescope, which were stitched together to create a 1.5 billion pixel snapshot of the Andromeda Galaxy. If you think your photos are taking up too much space, this one picture requires almost 4.5 gigs of space to store, but it is well worth it. We shared a video that attempts to illustrate the scope and scale of NASA's picture. You can check it out on our Facebook page at facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. Whether you've seen it on Facebook or a digital photo sent by the proud parent or in your very own albums, it seems that every time a newborn baby is photographed, it's wrapped in the same candy-striped hospital-issued blanket. So where the heck did they come from? And why does every hospital seem to use them? We're going to find out after the news.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth. Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you've had children of your own, if you are on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, you have almost surely seen them. Newborns swaddled in a white blanket with blue and pink stripes. That blanket is part of the Cuddle Up line made by a healthcare company in Illinois, manufactured in Pakistan, and swaddling newborns the world over. The writer Lisa Sellen Davis looked into how the Cuddle Up blanket achieved world domination. And Lisa Sellen Davis, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me.
First, can you describe these blankets for the, 8 to 20 people left who may not have yet seen them?
Yeah. They're mostly white. They're all cotton. And they have thick blue stripes and thinner pink stripes. I tried to get the name of the specific inks used on the blankets, but the company wasn't able to provide that. So it's kind of teal-colored and a dark pink.
And the company is Medline, which actually, you found out, came up with these jade green surgical gowns and scrubs that we see, on ER and in the hospitals. When did they get into the baby blanket business?
They got into the baby blanket business in the early 1950s. And the owner, A.L. Mills, was pretty innovative in terms of what he was doing before and how he handled fabric for different professions. So he had earlier designed surgical gowns and was told that the surgeon's eyes got very tired from the light reflection of these white scrubs. And so he came up with the idea of having these jade green scrubs to be easier on their eyes.
Hmm.
And he had the idea later of kind of doing the same thing for receiving blankets, more for aesthetic reasons. So he had an office full of women, and he polled them about what they would like to see. And so there were several designs, but this one, because it's unisex, was the one that the most people glommed onto.
Hmm. Well, so kind of an innovator. Has this design remained since the 1950s, the same look, the stripes?
Yep, the same one.
Wow. And just how ubiquitous are they, Lisa?
Well, I believe they sell 1.5 million a year, and that's just a fraction of the number of babies born every year, though, of course, they're reused, so that's just the new ones. They're not used in every hospital. In fact, we got a note from Kaiser Permanente that they have their own line of baby blankets with their own pattern. So they're not everywhere, but they're so common that, you know, they're an instant signifier of a hospital birth.
Which leads to another interesting portion of your article, finding this kind of parallel between the use of this candy-striped blanket and the rise in hospital births since the 1950s. What's behind this kind of increase in what you call institutionalized childbirthing?
Well, a lot of it has to do with the history of obstetrics and gynecology. You know, in the 19th century, childbirth was really what women did. You know, midwifery was much more common, and you lived more communally, and there was knowledge that had been handed down for generations, so there was less of a need for medical intervention, at least in terms of the knowledge around childbirth, right? There may have been a need medically mm-hmm. for intervention because, of course, there was a much higher infant and maternal mortality rate. So as hospital births increased, there was more standardization of materials, just as there was more standardization of medical practices around childbirth.
It's not just the U.S., but around the world, this blanket and the industrialized birth model is being exported. Why adopt it so readily in other places, do you think?
Well, some of it has to do with the belief that America, you know, is the premier country for all things medical. And my mother had edited this book called Childbirth Across Cultures, which was pretty fascinating to me because I assumed that kind of everywhere else in the world, or at least everywhere else in the developed world, childbirth would be a better experience because we've come to see childbirth as over-medicalized mm-hmm. in the States, and our C-section rate is constantly rising, and people consider that a real problem. And that's also, you know, related to the disappearance of this communal knowledge, this knowledge that gets handed down from generations. So we don't know how to handle breech births. We don't know how to nurse. We need lactation consultants, et cetera. So one of the things I learned from my mother's book was how difficult childbirth is in many other countries, how women are forced to be alone or not make noise in some places. Some places are wonderful. Scandinavia, you know, if you're pregnant, you might want to head over to Norway to have your baby. But in for instance, in some Chinese hospitals, the C-section rate is as high as 90% because that's what's considered a status birth, an American-style birth.
Mm-hmm. So now almost every kid born in this country gets photographed in that blanket. Any idea how many photographs have been taken of this little baby swaddled in this blanket?
I have no idea, and Facebook had no idea when I asked how many might be posted. They said, I believe they said 350 million pictures are posted to Facebook every day.
I'm guessing 347 million of those pictures are of babies, new babies. Well, it's interesting that every birth, so unique, you know, as we're told, every individual comes into the world differently, all getting their first online posts in the same blanket. So mm-hmm. what do you think's going on there? Is this a, you know, welcome to the industrial world?
I don't think the parents think of it that way. I think it's just the modernization of the birth announcement. You know, used to make a card and send it out. Now we don't know anybody's addresses anymore anyway. So it's just shorthand for my baby has arrived, and we want everyone we know in our network to click like to welcome her into the world.
Well, Lisa, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your having me.
Lisa Selwyn-Davis writes about real estate and urban planning and design. We found her article, Why Every Newborn You See on Facebook is Wrapped in the Same Baby Blanket for Quartz. There's a link to read it for yourself and to see many, many pictures of kids in the cuddle-up at wordofmouthradio.org.
Lullaby and good night. with roses bedight, with lilies we bed. Lay thee down now and rest.
Rates of teen pregnancy, births, and abortions have declined dramatically in the United States since peaking in the early 1990s. In 2013, there were 26.6 births for every 1,000 adolescent females aged 15 to 19, a record low for U.S. teens. And while birth rates have declined almost continuously over the past 20 years, some schools remain dedicated to teen pregnancy prevention. Juliana Farrow of the youth-based radio group Open Orchard Productions brings us this story of an interesting approach to pregnancy prevention in her high school.
The project was eye-opening. Teens should not have kids. The sack didn't even move, and it was still such a burden.
Welcome to The Harvest. I'm Juliana Farrow, and recently I got to try my hand at parenting by participating in my AP Psychology class's Flower Baby Project.
The purpose of the baby project
By the way, I should probably tell you, this is my teacher, Mr. Stoddard.
Show students, you know, that having a child is a huge responsibility.
The rules were simple. We are to carry around a 5-pound sack of flour disguised as a baby for 5 days. Part of our documentation was taking 3 pictures a day, one in the morning, one in the afternoon, and one at night. First things first, I had to think of a name for my child.
My baby's name was Stanley.
My baby, I named him Carlos.
My baby was named Hunter.
So my baby's name is Chris.
I went with George. Day one, show and tell. It was the first day that everyone brought their babies to school, and boy was I shocked. I barely had George, and I was already so protective of him. I mean, it was just a sack of flour. I remember not letting anybody babysit him. There was no way I was leaving him in the hands of someone else.
One time with the babies, people thought it'd be funny to leave 7 babies with me at a time, and I ended up dropping all of the babies, and they all kind of got in trouble by the teacher, and it was just kind of funny because I'm like, haha, I dropped your baby.
Some people proved to be more trustworthy with the babies, but how could you know?
So I was in the bathroom, and this girl comes out of her stall with her flour sack baby and asks me to hold the baby while she washes her hands. So I'm just kind of standing there holding her baby as she washes her hands. And I don't know this girl, but I felt very honored that she trusted me enough to hold her flower baby while she washed her hands. It was great.
Day two. The highlight of this day was when I took George horseback riding. We weren't going very fast, but I made sure that he was wearing a helmet and sat in my lap. Don't get me wrong, even though we weren't moving very fast, it was not easy to keep him safely cradled in my arms. At one point, my horse spotted a patch of grass and decided to trot over to eat it. Out of instinct, I just leaned forward to grab the reins and completely forgot about little George. Even though I was concerned that there was a possibility that he would tumble off the saddle, it was kind of a spur-of-the-moment thing, and I chose the reins over him. This made me realize, if he was actually a newborn, I wouldn't be able to put him on a horse and pose for a picture. Some of my personal hobbies would have to be put on hold.
I took him to In-N-Out, and it was kind of awkward. People gave me weird looks, and it was really annoying having to carry him around all week.
I had a baseball tournament with my brother, so I brought him all the way out there. And it was chaotic, a lot of people there, and I had a lot of things to do. It was helping out and stuff, so I thought I was a good parent.
Day 3 and 4. George was getting really heavy. 5 pounds didn't seem like much, but we had to support the head at all times, and with my backpack filled with heavy books, I started to notice how difficult it was becoming to properly hold George.
It was a 5-pound sack of flour, and on my A-days, I have to carry my English binder, my backpack, which is stuffed with textbooks, my sports bag, possibly a camera, and now I had an extra sack of flour. There were several times when I was almost late to my zero-period classroom because I was carrying so much stuff and I had to walk so slowly.
I mean, she got really heavy. I think I fed her too much or something because she was fat. Like, no baby is that heavy.
Day 5. Finally, it was the last day, and George was in one piece. Other babies were not so lucky.
On the second day, I dropped my baby and its head rolled off. I never found the head, but I replaced it.
So I was in chemistry class, Chem 2AP, and I was like, okay, I'm going to go to the bathroom. And so I left my baby there because I told somebody to take care of it because I didn't want to take my baby to the bathroom because that's just way too much stress. And I come back and my baby's hanging from the ceiling and like tied onto like this one string with like one arm like off. And I was just like, oh, that's really sad.
I enjoyed my 5 days of motherhood, and I found myself upset to part with George. It was an interesting project, and the weirdest part for me was the next week at school. It felt really odd not having him sit on my lap.
And by the end of the project, I realized that even though it's just a little flower baby, I got connected to little Hunter, and that I'm sure that's only a minuscule amount compared to having an actual baby.
Thank you for listening to my podcast. I'm Juliana Farrow, and if you would like to hear more stories like this, please visit us at openorchardproductions.org.
Stay with us for more word of mouth and an invitation to float your own craft into space. The Global Space Balloon Challenge is open to anyone with a few $100, a little time, and an abundant sense of curiosity and adventure. We'll hear more when word of mouth continues after a short break.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Getting to space is not cheap, but then again, if you're sending a balloon rather than a rocket, the risks and expenses are much lower. In fact, with the help of a couple of YouTube videos and a few $100, just about anyone can send a high-altitude balloon to the edge of space. David Gerson is a propulsion engineer at SpaceX and president of the Global Space Balloon Challenge, an initiative inviting teams all over the world to build and simultaneously launch their own high-altitude balloons. And David joins us now with more. Hello, David.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. This April, I know, is going to be the second year for the Global Space Balloon Challenge. First, what are you challenging people to actually do?
So there's sort of two parts to the challenge. The first is just to get out and fly with people around the world. High altitude ballooning is something that people have been doing around the world for decades, and we just wanted to give people an opportunity to fly together, learn from each other, rather than just go out and fly on your own, fly as part of an international community. And then the second part is that to inspire people to both help others in their community and to promote innovation, we have a series of prizes from highest altitude to best photo to best video to push people to really try to do innovative things and then get small, cool prizes as a reward.
So these high altitude balloons go up in the air. What are they telling us? What are they communicating to us? What's the purpose?
There's many different levels at which you can use high altitude balloons. The most basic level, you can go up and you can get pictures at 100,000 feet, which is high enough to see the curvature of the Earth and the black of space, which is just really cool. But you can also use them to do real science, anything from atmospheric research, looking at the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, to bioprospecting, where you're looking for life at the highest edges of the stratosphere. NASA launches very, very large balloons with space telescopes to look at various objects in space. There's any number of things that you can do, from very basic to incredibly complicated.
Who takes part in the challenge and why?
So the really exciting thing for us is that there was a huge variety of people. Anybody from university students just trying to do this and have a good time, to parents who've been doing this for years who are like, this will be fun, to finally a chance to do with my kid, to people who'd never flown before, who just got really excited about this new engineering project that seemed like fun.
How close to space do high-altitude balloons actually go?
Technically, they only get to about 100,000 feet when technically the edge of space is defined at around 363,000 feet. So technically, they are quite a ways off, but you get high enough to be above most of the atmosphere. So really, picture-wise and data-wise, there's not that much that changes from 100,000 feet up to 300,000 feet. Compared to the difference between ground level and 100,000 feet.
Some of the requirements for the balloons and teams entering into the Global Space Balloon Challenge are, it's got to have a parachute, it's got to have a camera, it's got to have a GPS locator so you can go figure out how to retrieve it. But some of them sound a little more intimidating, like each balloon has to have a radar reflector. So what's that, and is it something anybody can build?
A radar reflector is actually one of those things that it's unclear if you actually need, but it is mandated by the FAA. The idea there is you basically take some cardboard, you put some tinfoil on it, and then it theoretically allows airplane pilots to see a glint off of the balloon and increase the chance that you could either see it visually or it has a surface that can bounce off radar and you can pick it up that way. But a lot of countries don't require it, and it is probably the easiest thing on a balloon.
I read on your website that the most dangerous part of the balloon flight is not the landing, but something called the burst. Now, what's that?
So the burst is that point at which the balloon gets so big up at altitude that it ends up popping. And that popping can result in tens of Gs in your payload, which when you're landing, you're typically landing at around 5 meters a second. So it's not as high. But yeah, all of the videos, when you pop, everything sort of jumps around and jostles around. And if you're not careful, your GPS or your camera might fall off their mount, and then you either might not get the signal or you might not get the video that you want coming down, which is one of the most exciting parts. And so it's really important to keep that in mind and design everything to be sturdy, even way up high when you think there are very few forces.
Is there any environmental concern about having these balloons, you know, sort of land in the water or land in other places where they shouldn't be?
There aren't enough people who fly balloons that that's a concern, especially because when you put, even though $400 to $500 is cheap, when you have a GoPro or a $200 GPS on there, there's a huge incentive to get it back. So most people spend a lot of time. You start weeks ahead of time. There are plenty of online programs that you can use to predict your route. You put in where you're going to launch from. You look at the weather conditions, get an idea of where you're going to land, and then choose your launch location based on ensuring that you're going to land in an area that you can actually recover from.
How long is that process generally?
It can take anywhere from a couple days to a couple, like once or twice, a couple weeks ahead of time. It's usually good to start early just so you can plan ahead. But people go to great extents to recover their balloons. There was a team last year that was flying from Washington State and landed in the mountains and not only sent a couple expeditions of skiers out to try to find it to no avail, but eventually found someone who had a helicopter who was willing to fly in circles around the site, found the balloon, got off, recovered it, got back in the helicopter and flew out. So
wow.
People really like to find their balloons.
Last year was the first year for the Global Space Balloon Challenge. So what kind of projects and experiments did participants carry out?
The best design, there was a team from Purdue, a team of university students, who assembled what's called a zero-pressure balloon. So as I said, most balloons you fill and then they just sort of rise until they pop. A zero-pressure balloon actually equalizes at somewhere around 60 to 7,000 feet, just based on having an opening in the bottom that allows gas to go in and out. And so they assembled one completely from scratch, so bought the latex, cut it to the right shape, bonded it together, and then flew it completely successfully. And typically, only the more experienced or governments are the ones who do large zero-pressure balloons or super-pressure balloons. So it was really exciting to have a team come together and do that, especially as part of the Global Space Balloon Challenge. Other teams flew experiments like flying an egg and then having it drop from 100,000 feet and trying to make sure that it survived the landing, which they did successfully.
Wow.
A lot of people looked at atmospheric data at various points. There's a team in Panama that is trying to work with schools all around Central and South America to look at the atmosphere for things like global warming and pollution. Really a huge variety.
Balloons, however, are not just used by the hobbyists and enthusiasts. A lot of private companies are getting into the action. So what are some of the more exciting large-scale projects right now that involve high-altitude balloons?
So certainly one of the first ones that comes to mind have been the two jumps from high up with Alan Eustace and then Felix Baumgartner. A lot of space tourism and the idea of being able to get high enough that you can see for yourself, not just through a camera, the black of space and curvature of the Earth is pretty cool. Google Loon, of course, comes to mind with the idea of flying balloons around the world to provide internet to people. NASA flies a lot of balloons out of their Antarctica Center. They've flown three in the last month. So definitely a lot of really cool things going on.
David Gerson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
David Gerson, president of the Global Space Balloon Challenge, now in its second year. The 2015 launch dates aren't until April, so you can still find a team or start your own. You'll find a link to the GSBC website, which has a load of more information at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. If you like what you heard, there's much more to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. Earlier in the show, we heard the confessions of a self-diagnosed digital hoarder about her compulsion to collect in the online space. And we'd love to hear your tips for dealing with digital detritus. Do you clean out your inbox on a regular basis? Do you have a system for sorting and organizing digital photos? You can share your tips on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.